You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 31st, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening.
And our special guest rogue this week is Eugenie Scott. Jeannie, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Jeannie Scott is, as most people probably know, the director of the National Center for Science Education. She has been waging almost a one-woman defense of the teaching of science and evolution in the United States for the last about 20 years, right?
Yes, but who's counting?
Actually, Evan was, before we recorded tonight, Evan was sending around a YouTube video. Have you seen this? Called Blast from the Past, Controversial Issues in Science Education. And it's 19, I think it's from 19 years ago. And it's an interview with you about the teaching of evolution. And at the time, it was scientific creationism was, you know, what they were going, the name that the evolution deniers were going by.
That's a wonderful video. I mean, other than the fact that, you know, I really look like 20 years ago, right? And
yeah.
With the big glasses and everything, but and actually have color in my hair at the time. So, you know, there is 20 years past after all. But that was a really interesting show, and the reason we put that up is not, you know, because I look 20 years younger, but because it was just before the big Supreme Court case, Edwards versus Aguillard, that decided that creation science was not legal to teach in the public schools. So it really is a kind of an interesting historic piece. And the guests on the show are me and a man named Jay Topkiss, who was the lawyer for Skadden Arps that argued the case before the Supreme Court. And a very, 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 very smart man. I really enjoyed meeting him. And then on the other side is Duane Gish and the legislator from Louisiana who proposed the legislation requiring equal time for creation science in the first place. So it was a very interesting meeting. Go take a look at it. It's on our NCSC website, and or it's linked from our NCSC website, and it's on our YouTube site. And I was very nervous. That was my first national television program,
and wow.
I was really quite. You know, I had just taken the job. This was like 1987 or 88, something like that. I had just taken the job at NCSC, and then wham, I got put on national TV. So it was quite exciting.
It still seemed relevant to me as I was watching it. A lot of the content, a lot of things you were speaking about, I mean, that conversation could have been recent, you know, if we didn't know better of the date.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It was, it's almost painfully relevant.
Right.
That the creationists are, in one sense, making the same arguments. And a lot of it is the old fairness idea. You know, let's be fair and teach both, and the usual attacks on evolution. Oh, evolution is such a weak science, and so forth. And of course, the fact that it is commercial television means that you can't get out more than a couple of sentences before, you know, you're either interrupted or they switch to commercial or something. So it's not a great medium for trying to express scientific ideas.
Yeah.
But I think it's very significant that a lot of the same arguments are still being made today, and maybe more to the point, are still effective with the general public.
Well, yeah, the fairness argument became teach the controversy, became the academic freedom approach. But
yep.
It's basically the same point.
Yep, it really is. The fairness argument has been the best thing that the creationists have had going for them. They obviously don't have the science, so they can't really do very well there. And the claim that evolution is inherently incompatible with faith also doesn't work, because Catholics and mainstream Protestants don't have a problem with evolution. It's just the conservative Christians. So the best thing they've got going for them is this plea for fairness, which really works very well with the American public. And,
yeah.
And, you know, in one sense, it's a good thing to be in a society in which people are encouraged to express their views. And we do have a vigorous debate going on about all kinds of things. On the other hand, fairness applies more to opinion than to empirical fact.
Right.
And that's the problem that we have with the fairness argument in science.
Yeah, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. Right.
Excellent. Yes, very well put.
Before we get on to some news items, Evan, you're going to tell us about This Day in Skepticism.
Yep. So March 31st, 1981, when a new single-cell genetically engineered life form patent was issued, the Pseudomonas bacterium can be used to clean up toxic spills because it can break down crude oil into simpler substances that can become food for aquatic life. That ability is possessed by no naturally occurring bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a June 1980 U.S. Supreme Court decision in the case of Diamond versus Chakrabarty held that forms of life can be patented if they are the outcome of human ingenuity and research and not nature's handiwork. And the ruling made by a majority, it was 5-4, it cleared the way for patents to be issued on genetically engineered mice and other animals. So very relevant court case that has,
yeah.
A long-term effect, a huge effect ever since then.
So you're saying that bacteria was designed?
Yeah, we're talking value added here,
right?
Yeah, I mean it's not just the raw little bacterium that you found, floating around. They tweaked.
Yeah, but what if you use an evolutionary algorithm in order to tweak your bacteria? Does that still work?
A human being has to devise that algorithm, or
if you use just artificial selection in order to create the bacteria, I guess that's sufficient human ingenuity to qualify under that ruling.
I don't know. I'm a scientist, not a lawyer.
Yeah,
I'm not.
asking the question in general, not necessarily of you.
Didn't the U.S. District Court judge just invalidated a patent on genetic mutations that cause breast cancer, which is kind of related to this, right?
Yeah.
The ACLU brought a case against Myriad, a company that was basically threatening to sue any independent lab that performed an analysis on a genetic mutation, which was a big step forward, which it was largely an unanswered question up until this point as to whether or not you could patent genes, basically. And apparently in the U.S., as of this point, you cannot.
Well, Bob, tell us about the nano war against cancer.
Well, guys, when you think of the future of medicine, what's one advance that you expect most people to want or predict? What's
bionic eyeballs?
Immortality?
No, not yet. People will get there, Steve. But
I want to be able to detect hunger.
What do people? Yeah, right. That's a just become Bob, a Scientologist and you'll be good. I know. I should have expected
modulate my own salinity, right?
skeptical utility belt. No.
Curing cancer, right? Isn't that kind of like the iconic answer? Like,
sure.
When science can cure cancer, kind of sets a standard. Well, we received a lot of emails, didn't we, this past week about a recent advance that could one day not only treat many cancers, but many genetic diseases as well. This one was pretty interesting. The California Institute of Technology, in conjunction with the biotech firm Kalando, I haven't heard of that one, they developed a method to deliver nanoparticles to the genes of cancer cells so that they pretty much just shut down, causing the tumor to starve to death.
How they do that? By cutting off the blood supply?
No, actually, they're kind of messing with the genes of the cancer cells. They're using this 70-nanometer ball of polymers and proteins. So it's a pretty tiny sphere that kind of sidesteps the immune system and attacks the cancer cells. But in the important bit is what's inside of the sphere. And it's a bit of RNA that's kind of like this deadly package inside this ball that kind of just fries the genes. What's going on here is that this RNA, it's not just regular old RNA. It's a special type of RNA called small interfering RNA, or siRNA. And it basically kind of enters the cell and it releases the cargo of RNA, which which basically prevents the cell's genes from making the protein that it needs to live. And the other cool part of this is that once this package has done its job, it kind of just unzips itself into tiny pieces, which you then excrete. So there's really, they're not going to be hanging out, messing with the genes of any other cells. RNA is ribonucleic acid. It's the key molecular machines that cells use to make proteins. When a protein is needed, what happens is that a copy is made of the DNA in the nucleus of the cells, and this copy is of a specific area of a gene that makes the protein that's desired at that time. So this copy, this RNA copy, is called messenger RNA, mRNA, and it kind of just leaves the nucleus, which is the protected area of the cell, and kind of goes out into the cytoplasm of the cell, and then other types of RNA and other mechanisms within the cell, organelles, they can read these mRNA's instructions and they make the desired protein. So that's kind of a really simplified version of what RNA is doing. Now, RNA interference is the other side of this coin. This is the key part of this discovery that these guys made. RNA interference was discovered in 98, and it actually won a Nobel Prize in 2006. What RNA interference does is it's evolved to control gene expression itself. This type of RNA attaches to other types of RNA. So you've got these little tiny strands of RNA that attach to the bigger strands of RNA, and it controls how active or inactive the genes are. So if it attaches to messenger RNA, basically it's preventing this messenger RNA from making the protein, so that the gene is effectively silenced, so that it's not expressed at all. And this is what's inside this little nanoparticle. You got this little bit of these small interfering RNAs that kind of just latch on to the messenger RNA and prevent it from creating any proteins. So this phase 1 trial from Caltech had these key results. First off, they found that the nanoparticles enter the cancer cells. They showed that the more nanoparticles you inject, the more of them show up in the cell. That's really good, because that's the dose response effect, and that's kind of important. And then finally, they found evidence that messenger RNAs were actually degraded. They found in the blood of these test subjects, they found little messenger RNAs that have been cleaved in two by these the small interfering RNA. So the small interfering RNA goes in there and just kind of breaks apart the messenger RNA, preventing it from doing what it needs to do. So they found evidence of that, which is the first time that's ever been done in a person. So to close this up, a couple reasons why I think this technique has incredible potential. Senior author Dr. Antoni Ribas, he's a researcher at UCLA's Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center, he said there are many cancer targets that can be efficiently blocked in the laboratory using siRNA, but blocking them in the clinic has been elusive. So we already know that cancers can be blocked in the lab using this technique. The problem, though, for years has been how do you get these particles, how do you get this stuff into the body? And this is exactly what these nanoparticles are letting us do. The other aspect of this I really liked was that, it's a quote from Dr. Mark Davis. He's a professor of chemical engineering at Caltech. He said, every protein now is druggable because its inhibition is accomplished by destroying the messenger RNA. So proteins are hard to target because the vulnerable parts of the protein that you want to grab onto to destroy it, sometimes they can be hidden away. You know, picture a three-dimensionally folded bit of protein. You've got all these folds and stuff, and sometimes you just can't get to the part that's vulnerable because it's hidden behind these folds of protein. This technique lets us conceivably target any protein because we can stop it at the messenger RNA level before it's even created, kind of like killing John Connor's mother before he's born.
Bob.
Yeah, Jay.
Doesn't this sound too good to be true, though? This is like a panacea type thing, you know? It just sounds like it's promising way too much, and even though like the technology and the science behind it sounds very involved and interesting, I just don't know about it. Don't know.
I've been reading about cancer cures for years and years and years, and a lot of them looked really interesting, really plausible, and of course you wait and wait, and you know this is such a difficult thing to crack. I understand why you have so many false roads that we're going down, but hey. I mean, this looks good. I mean, I've looked at a lot of these cures.
Messing up the RNA is pretty impressive.
It really is.
Yeah. This is a good new approach, right?
Yes.
It's a new technology. But Bob, you know, I will disagree a little bit. While in general, you know, those of us who consume the science tech news on the cutting edge. It seems like you're waiting forever and it's never manifesting. Like, again, we still don't have our flying cars. But in the world of cancer, yep, the things that you were reading 5-10 years ago are actually getting to the clinic. The difference is they're making incremental gains,
right,
in cancer survival. They're not, quote unquote, curing cancer.
Right.
And I think it's the same thing with this, is that these things all do pan out and they do have an effect, but they make an incremental benefit. And over the last 50 years, we've slowly been increasing cancer survival and
yeah,
cure rates. There just isn't this one big dramatic, suddenly now cancer is cured. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think we're going to just continue to make incremental improvements.
I think we will. Well, I agree, Steve, that yeah, we have made incremental advances. And I'm not looking at – those are the things that – I don't track those techniques, these slow incremental changes. I'm looking – when I say I follow it, I mean that I'm looking at some of the real fringe stuff that could really, really pan out. You have to think, though, that, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, I think they could, you know, once we get in nanotechnology really ironed out in terms of like maybe true nanobots or true genetic engineering where you genetically modify bacteria or other organelles of the cell, I think we can at some point in 10, 20, 30 years, in one fell swoop, just wipe out a whole class of disease, just because it's not like a chemical change. It's not like it's not even a genetic change. You're just brute force going in there with a tiny device that knows what the cancer cell looks like and just kind of slices it in two. And there's no defense against that. I mean, if you know what a cancer cell is, it will destroy it.
It all sounds better in theory than it turns out in practice. That's my point.
Yeah.
And there are some things that sounded like the cure for cancer when they were proposed.
Right.
Like, oh, we're going to use a drug that's going to stop the blood vessel growth so that the cancer tumor, the solid tumors, won't have blood vessels and they'll shrivel up and die. Sounds great. Sounds like a cure. It actually works. It's just not a cure. It just increases survivability and cure rate, but it's, you know, it doesn't, as you say, wipe out whole categories of diseases. So the techniques work. It's just not necessarily the total kill or the home run that
it's portrayed
to be.
I don't think anybody was saying that, you know, aha, now we have the solution to cancer. We can all go home. I didn't get the impression from that description of the research at all. You know, if anybody's saying, here's the magical wand that we can wave and cure cancer, that's quackery, and all of us are quite well tuned to that. But let's not be too negative about the actual incremental successes that we've had. You know, the research on blood vessels was a step forward. This research where you're going after the RNA and destroying the RNA before it can build a protein, that's pretty cool. You know, let's at least be enthusiastic for that, but keep a sense of proportion that's not the end of the quest.
Yeah, no, I'm right with you. That's absolutely
my point. I just don't want you to be too negative here.
Yeah, I didn't mean to come off negative. The incremental improvements are then thanks for the opportunity to clarify. Because they add up, and they've add up to a continually increasing, you know, survivability with cancer,
right,
you know, with most cancers over the last years and decades. It's fabulous. But I do think that the lay press, the mainstream media, they think in terms of the cure for cancer. That's how they typically frame their stories, not here is another approach that will take us one more step forward. Yeah. So I think that the public sort of is constantly barraged with this notion of here's the cure for cancer, and then 5 years later, like, hey, what happened to that cure for cancer I read about 5 years ago? When in fact, well, it's being used. It just, you know, it was one more incremental but very, very useful. And again, I'm not meaning to denigrate that at all. Step. I think most diseases today that are very challenging, like the degenerative neurological diseases, like cancers, progress is continuous and incremental, not breakthrough cures. But the mainstream media, they frame things in terms of the breakthrough cures.
Well, you have lots of different kinds of cancer. You're not going to have a cure. And and I guess we could speculate on whether the public is sucked in by that. I'm not sure we really have data. It would just be pretty impressionistic. But, you know, I think there's enough understanding on the part of the public that nobody is looking for a cure. There is a war on cancer. I suppose it would have helped if the government had, and NSF and NIH had advertised it more as a war on cancers, plural. That might have been a little bit more helpful.
Yeah.
But, I agree. And I may be, in terms of, you're right, and I don't, I would like to see some actual data on what the public believes. I'm probably biased because I frequently confront quackery, as you say. And the quack approach to cancer is almost universally, we have the cure
silver
for cancer.
Bullets.
Yeah, the magic bullet, right? So that's whether it's, you know, Hulda Clark or, you know, anti-neoplastons or, you know, the orthomolecular approach or whatever. All of those quack cancer cures are the cure for all of cancer.
Well, and I can speak from hopefully a bit on behalf of some scientists I know. I've spoken to several scientists working in biology who, in order to secure funding, they feel that they have to
present, and
not to the point where they're misrepresenting their work so much as they're simply reframing it as, you know, that they might be looking for something like one very specific thing, but they frame it under the in this more general tone of you know, this cure for cancer, when in fact, you know, what they're actually looking at is one tiny part of another tiny part of, you know, moving forward towards possibly treating one type of what we call cancer. So I think that does, you know, tend to mislead the public a bit as in terms of what cancer is and how we go about fighting it on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And Jeannie, the other thing is Bob keeps promising us like huge increases in battery life, super powerful solar panels, flying cars, like all this stuff comes from Bob's desk. This is just another one of those things. You know, we got to be careful.
One of these days I'm going to be right.
I'm with you, Bob.
Well, between Bob's optimism and Steve's negativity, it
balances
equals
out.
I have to balance off Bob. Evan, tell us about psychics in Dutch prisons.
What?
No, this is not.
Yeah. This sounds dirty.
Don't.
It does, doesn't
this
it?
This is not a dirty joke, I assure you. This is unfortunate fact. Headline reads, and of course this is from the Telegraph of the United Kingdom, Dutch prisons use psychics to help prisoners contact the dead.
Oh, well, who else are you going to use, right?
Right?
Somebody had to do it. Not...
Paul Van Brie, a self-styled paranost, or clairvoyant, has been hired by the Dutch prison service to teach prisoners how to love themselves. Now, in quotes, he says, "I tell them that dead relatives are doing well and that they love them. That brings them peace." Big, strong men burst into tears. Mm-hmm. He has claimed that by talking to both the prisoner and the prisoner's dead parents, he can discover key psychological insights to help the prison authorities rehabilitate criminals.
Right.
Can't they just rent steel magnolias or something? Do you really need a psychic to make people cry?
No, instead the government is hiring this particular psychic along with others, according to him,
which will give them all the validation they ever needed, right
exactly, so that they can discover key psychological insights to help the prisoners rehabilitate criminals. Now, whatever happened to traditional, you know, psychiatrists and so forth, you know, dealing and treating prisoners and so forth, is that like gone out the window in the Netherlands? I guess that wasn't good enough, that they had to move into something a little more esoteric.
Couldn't the psychic spend that time finding the people who really committed the crimes? Because I think if you ask most of the population in prison, this is what I learned from Shawshank Redemption, is that they all say that they're innocent. So maybe the psychic could get going on something like that, and it would be a better use of his or her time.
Yeah, I was going to mention something along those lines. Like, you know, these people are in prison. Their life sucks, you know. Like, the baseline is that they're not really living a real life in there. They're going to be depressed. That's kind of part of the equation. Yeah. How happy can you be?
Right.
But this looks like an extreme manifestation of something that we hear from the likes of, you know, Von Prague and Edwards, that they're giving people closure, and it, you know, they allow people to feel good, so like, almost as if, you know, let's not focus too much on whether or not this is real or true. People feel better, and therefore they're providing a useful service. But
the ends justify the means.
Yeah, but I think the ends are not good. I don't think that it's a good thing to give someone either false closure or to distract them, you know, from reality with these kind of false hopes or deceptions. It's basically, I could deceive somebody if I deceive them into feeling good.
It's an ethical issue.
Yeah,
it really is.
It really is.
And I suppose it becomes an ethical issue on two levels. The person who is providing these alleged services either knows he's a charlatan or believes that he's doing something that's really worthwhile, in which case, from that standpoint, it's not unethical because he truly is trying to help. But then there's the ethical position of the incident itself in the context of the prison. The prison managers ought to realize that this is charlatanism and that it's not producing any long-term improvement in these patients because it's not based upon anything real. And it's very difficult to argue that you're making a substantial change in somebody unless you are actually dealing with real variables there. So
yeah.
It is unethical from the standpoint of the prison managers, may also be unethical in terms of the provision, the provider of these alleged services, depending on whether or not this person is doing this with a wink and a nudge or is self-deluded.
But I would argue that even if they're self-deluded, you could still say it's unethical because, in my opinion, part of professional ethics, part of being a professional, is due diligence. It means you're not just putting forward your opinion as if it is scientific or as if it is professional or validated. Even just believing it's not enough, right? Believing that I'm doing the right thing as a physician is not enough. I have to do due diligence to know that it's backed by evidence and it's the standard of care, etc. So I don't think being a deceived believer doesn't totally get them off the hook ethically in my book.
It depends. He may be he may believe that there are scientific data and experiments that prove his point of view. I mean, you know, that this is part of the self-delusion, perhaps.
Yeah.
But without knowing the details, we really can't say.
Yeah. It could ultimately get to a matter of competence. Right? He may not be unethical, but he may just be incompetent.
I think it is absolutely a matter of competence.
Yeah.
And let's not forget, though, that, you know, presumably there's a group of people who approved this person to come in and...
Yeah.
And do this.
This is where the administrator's responsibility comes in, and that's
the Dutch Justice Ministry is the group, the official body of the government, arm of the government, that hires the psychic to come in. Now you think they would consult with maybe the Dutch Health Ministry or the Dutch Science Ministry to kind of work together to see if, you know, this is valid or not, but apparently. Those kinds of checks and balances haven't occurred, at least in this
That's
case.
True, Ev, but, you know, also it's our job as skeptics, local skeptics should be moving in on that and doing something. We need some activists to get there and to help these people figure out, you know, what they're missing. They're definitely not educated to the point where they understand that they're being duped or this whole thing is a sham, so that's why we're here.
And guys, just so you know, this we can leave it with this, is that another case of the Dutch government failing their citizens in 2008, it was reported that Dutch officials forced some of their unemployed citizens to participate in past life regression therapy. And from that article from 2008, it said the long-term Dutch unemployed are being forced into regression therapy in the hope that coming to terms with their past lives will help them find a job. And uncooperative welfare claimants have been told they will lose their benefits unless they accepted the guidance of a regression therapist to help them get in touch with their past lives.
Wow.
What if you happen to be one of those people that doesn't have a past life?
Then you don't get benefits.
More people are alive now than have ever lived. So, yeah, there's got to be tons of people.
We didn't all have Cleopatra and Julius Caesar as our past incarnation.
I was a grave digger. I was a total loser in past life.
Don't forget aliens. I mean,
right, it's true.
The souls could come from elsewhere.
And animals, yeah.
I used to be a dinosaur.
I was a dragon.
that is a past life.
I was a bacteria.
What if you regress a a creationist, and it turns out that they were a Neanderthal from 50,000 years ago.
Awesome. Were or are?
Ugh.
that would be tough to accept, I suspect.
Right.
Although, yeah, actually, Ray Eve at University of Texas Arlington has actually published on this. He's done comparisons of creationists versus New Age enthusiasts. And in fact, he wrote an article a number of years ago with a great title, something like Why Creationists Don't Go to Psychic Fairs. And there really are two separate populations. So actually, I wouldn't expect that creationists would think that past life regression would even be possible. So, alas, we're not going to persuade them that they were once Neanderthals,
right.
However accurate that might be, since we were all Neanderthals at one point, or the equivalent.
It makes sense. I remember when I was a Christian, when I was a kid, I mean, I grew up knowing that Satan was behind any, like, you shouldn't meditate because that would allow Satan to get into your body. And
or the Ouija board.
Right. Ah, interesting.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we were taught that magic equals Satan, and you shouldn't dabble in that sort of thing. So,
well, magic, yeah, but meditation, that's not the
same
as magic.
Meditation was,
they lumped it all.
I remember we watched a video that still gives me nightmares with a girl who was into yoga, and she meditated for too long, and she became possessed by a demon.
Yoga possession, that's
awesome.
One other small point.
Oh my God.
I swear.
Evan, this guy calls himself a paranost, and that's the first time I've seen that term. If my etymology is correct, that means other ways of knowing or other knowing.
Ah, yes, paranost. Probably.
I never saw that term before.
I went to his website to read up on his bio and everything. It's all in Dutch, so
yeah.
I only got so far. But that word is in the first line of his bio.
Interesting. The next news item is also an item that we were emailed about from numerous listeners. And this is interesting. This is the headlines read that researchers have changed moral judgments with magnets. And I think there's two things here that triggered a lot of listeners' skeptical detectors. One is the notion of using magnets, which have been so thoroughly abused by quacks and charlatans that immediately raises your suspicions, but also just the very notion that you can alter someone's moral decision making by messing with their brain function a little bit with magnets seems to be a little extraordinary. However, nothing about this news item seemed out of the ordinary to me. It's actually an extrapolation of research that's been going on over the last 5 years or so. So I looked into it, and essentially what the researchers did was they used transcranial magnetic stimulation, right? So these are not the refrigerator magnets that you buy to, help your elbow arthritis, right? This is actually fairly strong magnetic stimulation at a certain frequency. So it's all, it's a dynamic magnetic field, not the static magnetic fields that a lot of quack devices are. And, neuroscientists have learned how to tune the frequency of transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, in order to alter the firing of nerves. It could either inhibit nerve conduction and therefore turn off, if you will, a little piece of brain function, or it can stimulate neuronal activity and increase the activity of that part of the brain. Very, very useful technique. These researchers had previously established using fMRI, also very tricky, but if it's done well, you can get some data out of it, that a particular part of the brain called the right temporal parietal junction is involved with what we call the theory of mind, what psychologists call the theory of mind, which essentially is your ability to understand that other people have thoughts and feelings. And then to use that to infer what other people might be thinking or what their motivations might be. An obvious, evolutionary advantage there, right? So if we realize that somebody might be doing something because they have their own reasons for doing it. But it turns out there's probably a piece of the brain that enables you to do that. When subjects were given tasks that engaged that ability, that part of the brain, the right temporal parietal junction, lit up. So the researchers were now following up on that research to do more of an interventional rather than just observational study to say, well, what happens if we inhibit the functioning of the temporal parietal junction? What will that impair the theory of mind? The whole moral judgment thing was that, even though that's what made all the headlines, was actually only tangentially related to the actual question that was being asked in the research, which had to do with, again, the theory of mind. But what they used a moral judgment in order to infer that. So this is the question, or you know, one of the types of questions that they asked subjects. Let's say two people are visiting a chemical factory. And one person asks the other to get them a cup of coffee. The other person goes to make the cup of coffee, and they see on the counter a container with some white crystalline substance that's labeled toxic poison. And they put that in the other person's drink deliberately, hoping to hurt them. It turns out that it was just sugar, and the other person is fine, right? So the point of that story is to separate out intention from outcome. The outcome was fine. It was just sugar. The person was unharmed. But the person intended to harm them and thought that they were putting poison in their coffee. So again, it requires the theory of mind, the ability to think about that person's motivation in order to make a moral judgment about them. They then asked the subjects to morally rate the behavior of the person who thought they were putting poison in the other person's coffee from completely prohibited to completely permissible. When the subjects were being subjected to transcranial magnetic stimulation that was inhibiting the function of their right temporal parietal junction, they tended to be more permissive of that behavior. So they tended to say, well, that was fine because everything turned out okay, as opposed to that person intended harm, and therefore that was not fine, even though it turned out it was just sugar. So, but of course, the mainstream media interpreted all that as you can use magnets to change people's morality, right?
Not quite what they were doing,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, right.
But
so, which is interesting, but it really was focusing on the theory of mind was really the bit they were interested in. However, this was a small study, and the effect size was also small. So the people only shifted a little bit towards the permissive end. So I don't know that we could really make too many conclusions based upon this until it gets replicated really with many more subjects. And also more, I think you have to vary the protocol more and really triangulate and say, is this really the common denominator here? So this is very, very preliminary. And just in general, whenever you see research based on either fMRI technology or transcranial magnetic stimulation technology, it's all really, really cool, but it's very tricky. And a lot of it is probably in retrospect going to turn out to be wrong, I think, just because the technique lends itself to false positives. You're picking out a very small amount of signal from a lot of noise.
Well, as you pointed out, they got a very small effect in the study.
So small effect size, small numbers of subjects. Generically, we consider that to be very weak preliminary evidence. If it all pans out, though, the implications are very interesting. You know, it always fascinates me. Of course, you know, I'm a neurologist, so I'm fascinated by neuroscience. The notion that there's a piece of the brain that is involved in a sort of a network among different pieces of the brain or modules that are engaged in specific tasks, and then we can manipulate or alter that function by, you know, now with the transcranial magnetic stimulation, by sort of enhancing or inhibiting the function of different bits of the brain.
So, Steve, what would that be used for? Maybe like mood-altering therapies or something along those lines?
Oh, we're nowhere near that. I mean, that this is really just a research tool. But I will say, if you want to talk about clinical applications, they're more crude. You know, we're not targeting specific, really, brain regions. There are two that I know of. One is using magnetic stimulation in order to essentially induce a localized seizure. And this is the modern manifestation of electroconvulsive therapy. So instead of using electricity to shock the brain into having a seizure, you induce activity with a magnetic field, and it gets, and that is to treat depression, actually, and it gets the same effect, but it's a lot more benign. than doing the electrical.
Didn't they use that for migraines? Isn't that one of the things that is being experimented with?
Yes.
With, for
and
migraine
that, that's the second one that I know of. I wrote about that a few weeks ago. There was a study that was published just a couple of weeks ago looking at transcranial magnetic stimulation occipitally, so in the back of the brain, in order to abort a migraine.
Oh, I got to read that.
Yeah, so that, and that makes sense. But it's, and what I think this is doing is ushering in, you know, this now I'm going to wax very Bob-like now, is ushering in a new age of potential neurological therapy. So, you know, the brain is an electromagnetic organ. Up to this point, a lot of our interventions have been pharmacological. So we're trying to alter the function of neurotransmitters, you know, the brain function biochemically. But actually, we can alter brain function electromagnetically. There are a number of therapies already based upon this. There are vagal nerve stimulators that are being used to abort seizures. There are deep brain stimulators, which are being used to inhibit the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And now, potentially, you know, if it pans out, there's, you know, transcranial magnetic stimulators to abort migraines. And this makes perfect sense. You know, so this may be, is like with the other, with Bob's news item, a new technology, a new way of modifying brain function without, you know, using biochemicals, right, without using pharmacological agents, just directly altering the electromagnetic function of the brain. And I think there's a tremendous amount of potential here, and I expect to see a lot more of this kind of research in the future.
Steve, I don't know, if you look at neurological treatments over the past few decades, I think you'll find that, you know, they're more incremental in nature than than sweeping changes. So I think you're full of it.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right.
The therapies
that I spoke of are absolutely incremental. I mean, we have not cured Parkinson's with deep brain stimulators. We've just inhibited the symptoms a little bit. We certainly haven't cured epilepsy with vagal stimulators. Just some people have, you know, are under a little bit better control with the vagal stimulators. So it absolutely is incremental, all kidding aside. But what's neat is that it's a new way to modulate brain function without drugs. Yeah.
And the more angles you approach a problem with, the better. You know, it's always better to have multiple angles than constantly coming at it from one perspective. So, and who knows, you know, maybe one of them will pan out in an incredible way, but it's always better, obviously, I guess.
Yeah, the more tools we have in our toolbox or weapons we have in our arsenal, whatever metaphor you want to use, the better, because not everything works for everybody. And many people need multiple approaches at the same time in order to improve their outcome sufficiently.
Right.
So, yeah, absolutely.
And that ties into the whole personalized medicine thing, which is really getting pretty popular.
Hey, Gina, you know what? If none of us talked, Bob and Steve could just go on for like 4 hours.
Probably any two of us could go on for several hours.
Right. Pick the right topic, right?
Well, you know, but this does bring up an interesting issue that we as skeptics are really concerned about, that it's not necessarily an easy thing to tease out the pseudoscience that actually has a kernel or a grain of actual science at its root, and something like this, which does have science at its root, but has been taken to a testing stage and is now being shown, apparently, that there's some there. So much of the time, you know, we get interested in pseudoscience because it's close to science. It's a lot of it is almost parascience, in addition to being paranormal. And there's some sort of kernel of actual science at the root, but they don't ever actually go all the way through the motions of properly testing it. So, you know, you get a little bit of kind of fuzzy support for it from some observations, and that's taken as confirmatory. And then they go off and counsel prisoners in Holland for past life therapy or something. I mean, you know, the really hard thing about science is figuring out ways to test your ideas.
Yeah.
And that's not easy. If you've ever supervised master's students or even PhD students, getting them to settle on a topic and figure out how to test it is half the game.
You know, I like news items like the two that we talked about tonight, because it actually tests me. You know, I have to sit there and think, hard about it. It's not obvious like other things like homeopathy or whatever. Like, you know, the guessing is over on that. But with these, you know, I am challenged. But, you know, it sounds kind of fake, but it also sounds plausible. And I have to really put the time in. And then, you know, I do the thing. I do that thing with Google. Like, I Google the experts. I want to know what the real people think, because my opinion, you know, I'm just interpreting what I hear from the experts, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we all ought to be doing, not just those of us who are interested in pseudoscience, but every member of society really is applying these kind of critical thinking skills to these sorts of things. And the hardest thing is when the explanation sounds plausible and you'd like it to be true, the hardest thing is saying, well, let's reserve judgment on that. Let's see whether this actually works. And that's tough.
Absolutely.
You're really looking for a solution to a problem.
Yeah, I think it's funny to put things like that, because you realize that when we talk about believers, meaning the them, they can be quite skeptical. It's just about different things.
Yeah. And Jeannie, I also think you're absolutely right in that a lot of times the pseudosciences that we confront, they're going 95% of the way towards doing science. But they're not going all the way. And I think that the key difference is that, you know, the quote-unquote real scientists, at the end of the day, they want to know what's really, really true. Whereas the pseudoscientists typically want to confirm their belief. We spoke last week about Lloyd Pye, the guy who thinks he has a skull of a hybrid human alien. And he's doing confirmatory science. He's doing everything he can to confirm his belief. He's not trying to find out what's really, really true. And that's enough to make the difference between pseudoscience and genuine science. Well, let's move on to Who's That Noisy? Evan, can you play the noisy from last week?
I will. And this will be fun because, Jeannie, you're a very, very busy person. I'll assume and we'll forgive you that you did not listen to last week's episode.
That's true.
So you're gonna hear this for the first time, and I would like you to try to guess and see if you recognize this voice.
First, we learn from Bernoulli that when a moving fluid like air encounters a constriction, that is a narrow space, the velocity increases.
Does that sound familiar?
No, it doesn't. But it sounds fairly old, not just because it's scratchy, but just the whole kind of cadences that this British man is using are cadences that you don't tend to get in. It sounds like he's teaching a lesson of some sort. But no, I'm afraid I can't tell you much about who is this gentleman.
Have you ever heard of Professor Julius Sumner Miller?
No, I haven't.
American physicist and television personality, best known for his work on children's television programs in North America and Australia.
What year?
What decade?
For several decades, actually, starting in the 60s, from 1962 to 1964, Miller was Disney's or Walt Disney's Professor Wonderful on new introductions filmed at Disneyland Studios for the syndicated return of the Mickey Mouse Club. And then during the same period, he appeared on a semi-regular basis performing physics experiments on Steve Allen's late-night TV show.
Oh, wow.
Wonderful.
He's best known in Canada for his work as the professor on the 1971 hit TV series The Hilarious House of Frightenstein, or Frightenstein. And we have a lot of people who, I know a lot of our listeners knew exactly who this was. And
wonderful.
Quite
oh, that's just a delight.
But Jeannie, you were totally right. You predicted that he was teaching someone. You know, that's funny that you could pick that up from, you know, imagine if that guy talked like that all the day.
Honey, this is my day job.
Honey, I'd like a steak with a glass of soda, please. You know, like. You.
Sounded like a Bill Cosby.
Yeah, I did.
With the drizzle and the frizzle.
It almost sounded, it sounded like a performance. It sounded like almost like a vaudeville performance of in fact, somebody trying to sound like a teacher, or in this case, obviously somebody, on stage trying to sound like a scientist. That's really quite delightful.
You know who else it sounded like? Phineas J. Whoopi.
Who's that?
Who's that?
Oh, come on.
Oh, from the
Phineas J. Whoopi, oh, you're the greatest.
The Tennessee Tuxedo and Chumlee.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Because he was a professor.
It was part of the Underdog series of cartoons.
And had the same theatrical professorial kind of explanations in almost the same accent, too.
Underdog was the shoeshine boy, right?
Yeah. Yes.
They taught science in that show.
Okay,
that
can you tell
show.
Me this?
There is no need to
I hear. Have a question about
yes.
this. Why was Underdog a shoeshine boy and not a shoeshine puppy?
That's one of the mysteries of life.
Right?
Oh, well.
Because the boys get bigger tips than puppies.
Well, it doesn't work unless you anthropomorphize, I guess.
Because that was his costume. That was his alter ego.
It's too much for me. But he wasn't... He didn't hide his dogness.
Well, he did, just not very well. Hey, if Klondike Cat can be a Canadian Mountie, then...
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Right. Never mind.
Are we dating ourselves, Rebecca? Is that what's happening?
Well, nobody else will.
Now you're going to tell me you've never heard of the Go-Go Gophers.
Go-Go Gophers. Awesome.
Wait. Who won, Evan?
The winner this week was Open Mind from the message boards. That was his second post, so... Thank you to Robert Wilson from Australia, who sent in the suggestion to play something by Professor Miller. So thank you, Robert. All right.
And this week.
Now for the moment Jay's been waiting for, which is this week's Who's That Noisy? Let's see if you guys can guess this one.
He wasn't very impressed. So finally he asked me a few questions, mostly how long did I work with this system and so on, and departed, saying few words to the director of the laboratory. Later on, I found out that what he said was, put his guy to work on something more useful.
Thank you, Evan. Let's go on to a couple of your questions and emails. We have time for one email question this week. This one comes from Mike, and he writes, I was inspired by Bill's email last week to ask something that has been really bugging me. I love your show, and I've been listening for the last 2 years. Something that comes up over and over, and I don't think I've heard it addressed, is how the skeptical movement is somehow married to atheism. This opinion comes from the numerous guests and conversations you have had on the show. Atheism is an actual belief in something that has no proof. This doesn't seem internally consistent with a skeptical outlook. It would seem to me being agnostic would be the natural outflow of being a skeptic, but this, in general, does not seem to be the case. Yes, I have a limited sampling size. I think this is a major aspect of the movement that inhibits its growth and acceptance. I'm sure you guys have thought through this, and I would love to hear this discussed. Do you guys think it damages the movement's ability to reach people? Is it internally consistent with skepticism? If so, how?
Can I kick this one off real quick? Because this is a pet.
Yeah. Go right ahead.
It's a common newbie sort of thing, I think, to swoop into the atheist versus agnostic versus skeptic discussion with your own predefined atheism. So you've already decided that atheism is, quote, an actual belief in something that has no proof. That's your definition of atheism, Mike, but it's not many other people's. And speaking personally and for, I know, many other atheists, atheism is not a belief in something. Atheism can most often mean lack of belief. That's, if you break down the word, that's what it means. There are people out there who believe, who call themselves atheists, who say that they steadfastly believe that there is nothing out there. That's another definition that can be used. But it's not the only definition used. So whenever you're talking about these sort of things, you do need to set out what words you're going to use to mean what.
Well, obviously, definitions are very important in all these kinds of discussions. But it's not just a newbie thing. I mean, I'm an old time skeptic. I mean, I've been in the skeptical movement since the 70s. So that yes, I am really old. And there has been this tension between the skeptics' orientation, which is looking at claims of the paranormal, looking at pseudoscience, the stress upon critical thinking as a way of understanding the natural world, of science as a way of understanding the natural world. And along with that has been a parallel movement of humanism, which is a philosophy, if you will, a belief system of there is no God, there's only naturalism, there's only naturalism as an ism, as an ideology, and that this is not just the best way to understand the natural world, the methodological naturalism, but also philosophical naturalism, that explaining things and understanding the universe in terms of natural processes and empirical evidence is the superior ideology to have. Now, there are many of us who are not believers, who are not not people of faith, who are associated with the skeptics movement in this critical thinking, concern for the concern for analyzing the paranormal, etc. But there are many of us in the skeptics movement who are theists. And there has, but partly because the origin of the skeptics movement was from PSYCOP, was from Paul Kurtz and his associates, who also simultaneously were organizing a humanist movement. And so the two became conflated over the years, although they actually had an independent beginning. And there's a very lively discussion going on about how close should these two movements be brought together. If you are a skeptic, are you automatically a non-believer? Are you automatically an atheist? Well, obviously, empirically not, because there are many very active skeptics who are concerned about the paranormal who are believers. And Mike, was that his name, wanted to know, do you think it damages the movement's ability to reach people? Well, if the skeptics movement is concerned with analyzing the paranormal, helping people make choices about claims that are made around them, particularly in terms of things like medicine or, you know, things that are directly relevant to people. If you say, well, sorry, the only people who are allowed to think this way are atheists, well, then obviously you're truncating your movement. The good news is that it's not necessary to do that, depending, as Rebecca said, depending on what your definition of atheist is. But there is a distinction between science as a way of knowing and ideologies that may be built upon or inspired by science. And I think that if what we're trying to do is encourage people to be critical thinkers, to look at these claims of quack medicine or claims of the paranormal of various ways, that really can be injurious to people. I think that it behooves us to think very carefully about what we mean by science. And to my understanding of science, it does not exclude somebody who, for ideological reasons, is a theist.
Yeah, there's basically three issues that come up in this email. One is the semantic issue, which I think is what Rebecca was focusing on.
Yeah, and actually, I just want to be clear that when I referred to a newbie mistake, I didn't mean asking a question about whether or not skeptics and atheists should be, you know, necessarily considered one and the same and whatnot. I think that's an interesting question that can always be discussed. My point was merely, I think it's a bit of a rookie mistake to go into this sort of discussion with the assumption that your definition is the correct one. That's all.
Yeah, but and because certainly there are people who call themselves atheists who use atheism as an ideology.
Yeah, and a lot of people call themselves atheists, but when you really, you know, pin them down philosophically, they're applying it in the same way that, you know, I would apply the label agnostic, right? And the way it was meant by Huxley, who essentially invented the term agnostic to describe his own beliefs, in that, it's a lack of belief in anything. What, you know, and you may take it one step further and say that, well, I don't have any belief about the existence of things outside of the realm of the knowable because it's unknowable. And all you know, science is agnostic towards those things, therefore I'm agnostic towards those things. Mm-hmm.
And there are people who call themselves atheists who don't actually have a philosophical system at all. To them, atheism means just being anti-religious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, there isn't an ideological position in there. It's just, we don't like the other guys, which, you know,
yeah.
is another whole set of ideas.
So, yeah, so there's a semantic issue, which I hate getting bogged down into, and there's really unresolvable, you know, because it ultimately comes down to how do you choose to define certain terms. But I think the
Yeah, and then use the definition consistently.
Right, but yeah, I think just pick definitions and use them consistently. And then there's the sort of the real philosophical issue, which also, you know, I certainly agree with you, Jeannie. That's been my experience in the skeptical movement. I know we've discussed this before. The notion of, you know, how closely is critical thinking and science essentially just methodological naturalism, which is basically what we follow on this show, methodological naturalism, versus philosophical naturalism, whereas, you know, you have to believe that the universe actually is this way, not just this is the only way we could know about it. That debate, I don't think, is going to end. And you're right, definitely, you know, Paul Kurtz and others take up the philosophical naturalism end of things. And that's fine. Again, our approach has been sort of the big tent approach of we don't have the ultimate answers or the one way to do this. This is just our way, and it's fine, you know. And then there's the pragmatic issue that he raises in that what's best for the skeptical movement. And again, I agree that it's sort of the big tent approach. We're here trying to teach people critical thinking, and that will bear whatever fruit it bears, right?
Yeah, I mean, and if you require a particular ideological purity in order to be a skeptic and think critically about, you know, quack medicine mm-hmm. or Bigfoot or whatever, then you're obviously going to be having fewer people at the table. So from a purely practical standpoint, your approach, I think, is much more adaptive.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and you all can play along. Is everyone ready for this week?
Indeed.
Yes.
Quite.
We have a theme. We have a theme this week. The theme is Earth history.
Ooh.
And here are the items. Item number one, geologists have resolved a decades-old mystery as to why the Earth was not in a permanent ice age for its first 3 billion years. The answer is that there were far fewer clouds to reflect sunlight. Item number two, new evidence supports the theory that the Younger Dryas, a 1,400-year mini ice age beginning 12,800 years ago, was caused by falling atmospheric CO2 levels. And item number three, new research reveals that dinosaur skull shapes may change radically as dinosaurs mature. Jeannie, since you're our guest this week, I will allow you to go first.
Lucky.
Allow.
Lucky guess.
Well, let's see. I'm trying to pick the one that is not the story.
The one that's fake.
The one that is fake. Well, let's see. Fewer clouds to reflect sunlight certainly makes sense. If it's really, really cold, that means that you're not going to be, it would seem to be, you would not be getting very much moisture, which would reduce the amount of clouds. Because you have to have that sort of condensation, evaporation kind of thingy. So I think item one sounds plausible. The Younger Dryas argument, the mini ice age caused by falling atmospheric CO2 levels, I really don't know very much about that at all. I'm going to have to take a pass. The idea that dinosaur skull shapes may change radically as dinosaurs mature, you know, it depends on what the meaning of radically is. certainly growth can change shape. Clearly, I mean, we've got plenty of, you know, that's what I used to do when I was a physical anthropologist. But, you know, radically, I'm not sure how radical is radical. You certainly can get some pretty substantial shapes when you have a long period of growth, or when you have, substantial growth. You start out really little and you end up really, really big. Then, yeah, you could get some pretty radical changes. So because dinosaurs are really, really big, my reasoning might go that, I would go with that one. But then I'm sort of guessing 50% because I really don't know much about, you know, chemistry and CO2 levels rising and falling, and what that would do with climate. So I'll say the research on dinosaur skull shapes is
the fake.
The fake.
Okay.
With lots of qualifications.
All right, Jay.
Okay. The first question, number one, about the there being fewer clouds to reflect sunlight. I mean, I love stuff like that. I love thinking about like how the Earth evolved in the beginning, you know, and like where did all the water come from? You know, what was going on the surface of the Earth during that time period and everything. And this does make sense. The second one, I have absolutely no idea about. And it sounds plausible, but I don't know anything about it. And the third one, new research reveals that dinosaur skull shapes may change radically as dinosaurs mature. My head is kind of getting weird looking as I get older. I kind of believe this one. Oh, my gut's growing too, but that's not made out of bone. But that's another topic. So I think that one, this sounds a little shifty to me. I'm going to say that one's the fake.
Which one's the fake?
The skull changing shape.
Okay, Rebecca?
Okay, see, I liked that one, although I'll admit it's mostly because of the way you formed the question. You said research reveals that dinosaur skull shapes may change radically as dinosaurs mature, using the present tense, which automatically makes it wrong, unless there are dinosaur skull shapes that are currently changing radically. However, I'll assume that you're just not good with English.
So, me fail English? That's impossible.
It's impossible.
It's a perfectly cromulent way to put that sentence. So I actually think that one's correct, because it's plausible that a species could drastically change, radically even change shape as it matures. And I think because you're so generic there, you're so nonspecific, that makes me think that that's probably true. And I also think that it's true that there were fewer clouds to reflect sunlight, and that's maybe why the Earth wasn't in a permanent ice age for the first 3 billion years. And so by process of elimination, I'm going to say that it is not true that the 1400-year mini ice age was caused by falling atmospheric CO2 levels. Not because I know anything about the subject, but just purely through process of elimination.
Alrighty, Bob?
Yeah, that's funny, Rebecca, you say that, because I'm going through the process of elimination this week as well. The first one with the geologist resolving that mystery, yeah, it was now a pretty big mystery as to why the Earth didn't just become an ice ball and just never get out of it. You also take into account that the sun was also putting out less radiation back then as well. So, yeah, it should have been pretty cold and it should have stayed cold. But it makes sense that cloud cover would change that. So without, you know, with a lower albedo or albedo, however you
libido.
Pronounce that word.
Libido, Bob.
Jinx.
Yeah, there'd be more light getting through the atmosphere and warming the Earth and preventing it from freezing. So that one sounds plausible to me. The third one also makes sense. Now, I remember reading many months ago about this. I get it, so this isn't the new news item I'm referring to, but something pretty old about skull shapes, about dinosaurs changing so radically that that many species have, you know, can be boiled down to really just one, and it kind of is related to this. So that kind of makes me think that the dinosaur skull one is also possible as well. So by elimination, again, like Rebecca, number two with the younger Dryas and the falling atmospheric CO2, I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Evan, it's 2-2. You're the tiebreaker.
Oh, I love being in this position. Well, right. So I obviously haven't read any of these. I'm quite in the dark, I should say. Just because I have to pick, I'm going to say that the falling atmospheric CO2 levels one is fiction.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. All right. So you all agree that number one is true, that geologists have resolved a decades-old mystery as to why the Earth was not in a permanent ice age for its first 3 billion years. The answer is that there were far fewer clouds to reflect sunlight.
We said it was plausible. We're giving ourselves a wiggle room here.
Okay.
There is no wiggle room. Jeez.
You catch on quick.
It's not only plausible, it's actually white. Science.
Yay!
We're
science.
We're so good.
And this was a mystery.
Solved the mystery.
Yeah, but, did you read this one, Bob?
Maybe.
Because you were right. The big mystery was that, if you look at stellar evolution, the sun was putting out a lot less sunlight back then, and there was really no way to explain why the Earth wasn't therefore a lot colder. So the thinking was, well, there must have been more CO2 in the atmosphere, therefore more of a greenhouse effect. And it was calculated that at the Earth should have been about 30% CO2 in the atmosphere for that first few billion years in order to explain why it wasn't just an ice ball. However, measurements have shown that while there was a little bit more CO2 in the atmosphere back then, it was still just like 3 or 4%. It was far less than the 30% that would be necessary. So that wasn't the explanation. Well, Professor Minik Rosing did some investigation, and what he found was that the clouds that we have today are dependent upon substances that are made by bacteria and algae. And without, the world's oceans full of these things, that there wouldn't be the seeds necessary to form the cloud cover that we have. That therefore, in the early Earth, there would be far fewer clouds, and that would allow more sunlight to penetrate the atmosphere and warm the Earth. Also, there a larger percentage of the Earth was covered by water, and that would tend to hold on to the heat more.
Higher heat capacity than the land?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's basically what it comes down to. So it would have been enough to keep the oceans from freezing, basically, which is all you need, to avoid that deep freeze that would have otherwise theoretically occurred. So it was cloud cover, and the reason for the less cloud cover is because there just wasn't as much stuff in the atmosphere from bacteria and algae. So that one was science. Let's go on to number two. New evidence supports the theory that the Younger Dryas, a 1,400-year mini-ice age beginning 12,800 years ago, was caused by falling atmospheric CO2 levels. Jay and Jeannie, you thought this one was science, or at least plausible. And the rest of you thought this one was the fiction. And this one is the fiction.
Sweet.
Yeah, baby.
Dinosaurs are alive.
So, and the reason is, this is a real news item, though, but I altered it. The news item is that what researchers have found is that the Younger Dryas was caused by melting glaciers, causing a mega flood,
right,
which drained across Canada and emptied copious amounts of fresh water into the North Atlantic. That decreased the salinity of the North Atlantic and shut down the Gulf Stream.
Wait, I think I've heard about this flood.
Yeah.
Did it create the Grand Canyon in several days?
Not that flood.
Not that flood. And then that decreased the moving of warmth up towards Europe and really plunged North America and Europe into this mini ice age. Where it was.
Can you imagine? We're talking
cold.
About floods. This past few days, Connecticut news is just filled with all these floods because we've had crazy rain. And can you imagine that flood?
Gouging,
going through the middle of the country and flooding the ocean with fresh water. Wow, I'd love to see that.
Now, of course, wouldn't you love to have a high-definition video of these historical events?
Yes.
The one I always wanted to see was when the land bridge between Spain and Africa broke, and Gibraltar, mm-hmm. and the Mediterranean flooded from the Atlantic Ocean.
That would have been pretty
impressive. And Atlantis sunk. Right. Yeah, cool.
I'm still hoping for cloaked alien satellites that recorded everything for the past 4 billion years, so cross your fingers on that one.
They wouldn't have cloaked because there weren't any people around to watch.
Right, good point.
Right, but they're cloaked now.
Yeah,
that's now, right?
They
have to be.
Jeannie, do you see why we can't trust
Bob dreams?
This is why we can't trust anything Bob
says. He's a dreamer.
Works for me.
A little special pleading there, that's all right.
Yeah,
so,
right.
And this has relevance because if you believe that whole global warming thing and the ice sheets on Greenland melt and dump a lot of fresh water into the North Atlantic, this can play itself out again. and therefore global warming could paradoxically produce an ice age in the Northern Hemisphere, in Europe and North America.
This is why it's called global climate change.
Yes,
climate change. Not really global warming. I mean, global warming misleads people. It's you know, it's like all these people. Well, never mind. We digress. You need to tell us about dinosaur skull shapes.
Yes, so new research reveals that dinosaur skull shapes may change radically as dinosaurs mature, and that one is science, despite the tense. And this is actually a very significant matter of controversy among dinosaurs.
So it's controversial, so it's not fact.
Hang on. What's controversial is the degree to which dinosaurs can change their skull shape as they mature.
Why do you keep using the present tense? What do you know?
Specifically, you know, as you look at fossils, the fossils are here today. So if you're looking at these fossils, are the you know
they're
know
not changing?
So
of course she knows what you're saying. She's being
is changing.
As you recall, we've had Jack Horner on the show, and we discussed this controversy. The question is, if you have like five or six different looking specimens of Triceratops, are they different species or are they just different ages of the same species? He thinks that they're different ages of the same species and that the Triceratops skull can undergo radical morphological changes as they mature, even to the point of like horns going from turning up to turning down and things like that. So this research would tend to support that end of the controversy, that dinosaur skull shapes actually do change a lot as dinosaurs mature. And therefore, maybe there are fewer dinosaur species than were previously thought. This one, however, is not looking at Triceratops. They were studying the skulls of Diplodocus. And what they found was in the skulls of what they considered to be clearly juvenile Diplodocus, that their skulls were actually very angular, very narrowly pointed, like they came to a triangular point, whereas adult Diplodocus had a very square front to their skull.
Cool.
So a very significant change to the overall skull shape from the juveniles to the adults. Very cool.
Very
cool.
Indeed.
Jack Horner would be happy because that supports his end of the spectrum there. Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I do. This is from Jules Henri Poincaré. How is that?
It's good.
To doubt everything or to believe everything are two equally convenient solutions. Both dispense with the necessity of reflection. Jules Henri Poincaré.
That, good quote.
Yeah, that's good.
Poincaré. Here's the quote by Poincaré.
Well, Jeannie, it's been wonderful having you on the show.
Well, it's been fun being here.
Absolutely.
This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate
you
including me.
Thanks so much, Jeannie. This was awesome.
And we'll definitely have to have you on again in the future to keep us updated on all of your good work over at the National Center.
Happy to do so. There is an event that perhaps some of your readers, at least on the West Coast, would be interested in. The very first Northern California Skeptics Conference is going to be held on April 25th. It's sponsored by the Bay Area Skeptics, of which I am president, and the Sacramento Skeptics, which the president of that is a wonderfully enthusiastic and hardworking young man named Shane Trimmer. And we're going to be holding it in Berkeley on the April 24th, and of course, the name of it is Skeptical.
Skeptical.
Excellent. And if you go to
cool, I like it.
It is good. If you go to skepticalcon.org, you can see the speakers and find out about registration and all that. So I'm encouraging your listeners to check it out.
Cool.
Well, thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thanks,
very
Steve.
Nice show.
Our pleasure.
It's good to have you back, Rebecca.
Oh, thanks. Good to be back.
Fun time for all.
Definitely.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.